Good afternoon to all of you. Lovely job, choir. That was not an easy piece. It was so beautifully done, wonderful emotions. Thank you so much for those efforts. I bring you greetings from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, up north of the border. As you, we really enjoyed the last few days of nice warm weather. Of course, in Wisconsin, when you get 80 degrees in April, that typically means you'll get 10 inches of snow the following week. But we all obviously hope that that doesn't happen. I trust you had a wonderful feast, spring feast season, as we did up in Milwaukee. It's always great to rehearse God's plan of salvation and to be charged up. I'm sure as many of you, you can look back on a time in your life and have a bit of a significant experience that helps change your perspective on life. I work for an organization called Bombardier Recreational Products, and I work for a division that we make Evinrude outboards up in Milwaukee. Yes, we still make them in Milwaukee or south of Milwaukee. But a few years back, I used to work in purchasing. And one of the projects that I managed was outsourcing some parts to a far-flung place. And so the sermon today, I would like to share with you some of the experiences I had in that journey. Once again, life-changing, and hopefully I can give you a flavor for India, as my sermon is entitled Lessons from India. Hopefully you can glean from my experiences some of the lessons as well that I learned. Being a James Bond fan, subtitled From India with Love. I'd like to give the sermon in a few parts. First of all is the trip itself, share with you some aspects of India and traveling to India and what it is like. It's definitely a developing country. But the trip to India is pretty extensive. It takes about 16, 17 hours of actual flight time to get there. You start off in Chicago and heading over to, actually I have a little sound bit. It's probably not going to carry too far, but no, you can't hear it. Well, never mind. Pretend that there's Indiana Jones music going in the background there. But you have to fly over typically, connect somewhere in Europe, and then flying into Mumbai. India itself, once again, flying into Mumbai, first formerly of Bombay, made famous for where Winston Churchill visited when he was stationed in India. But we flew into Mumbai, and the actual area where we worked with was a little city called Pune, India. And traveling to India, my first trip over there, it was pretty rough because they said, you need to go. I said, I can go. They said, well, you're going to go by yourself. So this is my first trip to a third world country, and they said, here's your ticket. Here's your passport. Well, I had to get my own passport. Here's your visa, go get your shots, and good luck. So you arrive in Mumbai. If you fly to Mumbai, typically you arrive in Mumbai about 1 o'clock in the morning. And like I said, it's about connecting time, about 20 hours worth of traveling. You show up in Mumbai. If you're like me, you can't sleep on planes, and I can't sleep on planes, so I show up, I'm pretty tired, and I get dumped out into Mumbai. And when you leave the airport in Mumbai, it's a small little opening, like almost only two doors, but when you walk out, you hit a stream of people. 2 o'clock in the morning, there had to be thousands of people outside the Mumbai airport. What they were doing there at 2 o'clock in the morning, I have no clue. But they were all there. So you walk out, and I am supposed to get to the Prince Leela Hotel. There's no signs, there's nothing, there's just people. So I start walking along, and I finally notice on the fence there's different little signs for hotels. And finally, some guy comes up and goes, "Oh, do you want to go to the Prince Leela Hotel?" I said, "Yes, I do." He said, "Okay, come with me." "Who are you?" He didn't have any uniform on. He had nothing on. I'm like, "Well, why in the world would I go with you in some strange country?" So he pulls out this list of guest lists, and we start working down, and my name was on the guest list. So, okay, so that maybe it's a little bit more legitimate, but as for God's protection, we'll just give this a go. So I went with him, and thankfully, I traveled the 2 miles it took to get to the Princess Leela Hotel, which, by the way, that two miles took about 45 minutes. I could have walked quicker than how long it took to get there because of traffic. So that was my first experience with Mumbai. Woke up the next morning, met the folks from Kinetic Engineering, and started my two-hour trip from Mumbai to Pune. It used to be a six-hour trip, but they put in a nice interstate, so it only took about 2 hours to get from Mumbai to Pune. But India is a very, especially Mumbai, is a very dirty city. It's kind of like LA in that it sits on the side of the ocean, backed by mountains, and so there's not a lot of flow to clean out the smog. Not a lot of environmental controls. Everyone burns their garbage. So if you can imagine, quite an acidic smell combined with smog. It was quite an assault on the senses. And this is a typical scene on a side street heading through Mumbai. You notice the not only the gutters, but also they function as latrines on the side of the road. As you actually go through Mumbai, you will see the men using the gutters. This is a shot down the side street. Once again, everywhere you see, it's people, it's clutter, it's equipment, it's old shacks. So, once again, very an assault to the senses. It's good to know that India is quite cultured. They do have their McDonald's. As you can imagine, though, Big Macs are not the typical fare there that you would find. Chicken and soy products, lamb and so forth. But they do have McDonald's and such. Once you get out of Mumbai itself, though, and on the road to Pune, it's quite a beautiful city. Excuse me, beautiful country. Very, very picturesque. Trees, greenery, a lot of mountains. You know, once again, clear blue sky once you get out of Mumbai itself. I really enjoyed the visit or the travel from Mumbai out to Pune. You'll see a lot of scenes along the road like this, where in India, the technology, as you can imagine, has not advanced. But not only technology from a computer standpoint, electronics, but as well as building products and how they go about their everyday life. For example, this, if you haven't some haven't recognized it already, is where they make bricks. They do it the old-fashioned way, with the way they did it in Williamsburg 2 centuries ago, where they would pack the bricks in, they would dry them, they would stack them up into a big box, and that would become the kiln. They would put a bunch of wood and other burnable product in the kilns, light it a fire, and that's how they would cure their bricks. So interesting scene. Well, once again, getting back and then to Pune, you get back into the city life. There's one thing interesting about India it's known for. It's traffic. Traffic, it's very noisy. I called it choreographed chaos, and that's pretty much what it was. Even though they drove on the left side, or typically supposed to drive on the left side of the road, you couldn't always count on that. But the road was, as well, would be shared with bicycles, with motorbikes, small cars, large cars, pedestrians. Everywhere you looked, you would see people. You know, this is a shot out the back of the car. Nothing but people and honking and such. This is what I mean about you never know for sure. The roads are pretty narrow in many places in India. So when you would want to get around some of these trucks, you would take off, try to go around, and hopefully you would not meet an oncoming car, which in this case, we almost did. So the driver would slam on the brakes and dive back in underneath the truck. It's truly transportational Darwinism, if there's such a thing, where the largest survives. I finally thought I had gotten used to the traffic, because once again, nothing but honking, people slamming on brakes, you think you're going to hit people. Daylight, I finally got used to it. But on the way back from the plant, because not only did we meet in Pune, but we also met in the plant in a city called Ahmednagar. I'll get to that more in a bit. But that was a 2-hour drive from Pune. So coming back at night, one particular night, We got a very late start, and it ended coming back at night. So if you can imagine, once again, jet lag, you're trying to sleep, you really can't sleep, you're in a half a daze. Now it's like tenfold scary at night, because they won't use our headlights in India, typically. They'll drive without the headlights, and as you get close to a car, they'll turn the headlights on. So you'll be half asleep thinking everything's fine. Suddenly you'll hear honks and screeching tires, and you're suddenly kissing the car seat in front of you, and quite an experience. But that's what they're used to. I was talking to one gentleman over there, and he said it's interesting that when he comes over here to the U.S. And drives for a little bit, then goes back to India, he has to actually kind of relearn and train his sense of response and quickness, because if you don't have it, you normally end up in pretty bad shape. As I mentioned before, you share the road not only with pedestrians but also animals. In this case, I got it a little bit late, but the traditional oxen there are cows that would roam the street. But not only cows, you see elephants. I was visiting one supplier to this company out in the middle of nowhere, and we had to wait about 20 minutes at the road waiting for a herd of goats to clear off so we could continue on our path. The driver, I think it was the first driver that I had over there, hit a cow. The cow was fine. The cow was okay. Nothing's wrong with the cow. Cows are sacred, for those of you who don't know, in India, very sacred. So they get the right of way, no matter what. He hit the cow. He fasted for 3 days because he hit the cow. So you've got to watch out for the livestock in the road over there as well. By the way, I never got to drive. I wanted to. They would not let me. You could stop on the way home and pick up your chicken for dinner that night if you wanted to. Live chickens there in cages. As I mentioned, there's plenty of culture in India. Notice the Pizza Hut. But these are two guys walking along, and the Indian culture is the same as the Arabic culture in that if you see gentlemen holding hands, they're good friends, they're having a serious conversation. You did not see men and women have public display of affection in public. You would not see them touching or kissing or anything like that. That would be the culture. This is Mahatma Gandhi Road in Pune. I wanted to go to kind of the central shopping district. I wanted to pick some things up for the family. Take me to the best part, the best shopping that I can do in Pune, which is one of the larger cities and richer cities in India. And this is where they brought me, Mahatma Gandhi Road. And this was the best shopping in India. So you can kind of imagine, once again, what you faced. We looked at, I ended up not buying them, but I looked at possibly buying a couple rugs over there. And I show rugs, you've seen rugs before. But it's interesting, what's interesting about these rugs, they were telling me about the making of the rugs. To make one of these rugs, an artisan somewhere in a village in India would spend a full year, one full year, to make a rug of this quality. It was silk on silk. It was beautiful, beautiful, beautiful artwork. But one full year to make this type of rug by hand, and I could have bought it for about $800 if I wanted to. This is the actual plant in Abhinagar, which was making our parts. Beautiful location, well manicured. You don't see manufacturing facilities as nice here in the U.S. While I was over there, I got to interact with some folks and visit them in their home. That's me right there, by the way, if you can't tell. This is A.Y. Karapate and his lovely family. I worked with A.Y. quite a bit. He was running the project. The interesting thing about A.Y. and his two daughters is I had the opportunity to eat dinner, and it was a wonderful experience, but his two daughters did not like Americans. All they saw was, or knew about Americans, is what they saw on TV. And so they were kind of apprehensive, as you can tell, not smiling very much, about having to eat dinner. Delightful young ladies, And thankfully, end of the dinner, we were able to hopefully change your perspective a bit about Americans. So AY and his parents there. An interesting thing as well about AY and his parents. AY lived in this house. AY was considered one of the wealthier. It would be considered upper class, one of the wealthier ones in India, and this was his house. But how his house came to be, and this is how many people have nicer homes like this, is actually AY's father owned this property. And what they did was they built this house, which was, I'm guessing, about 800 square feet, maybe, but per floor. But the lower floor they lived in for many, many, many years. And so when AY got married, started to grow, what they did was they built then the second floor. And that's where AY and his family lives, and his mom and dad still lives downstairs. So there's two families sharing this house. Is about 1,600 square feet. And this is, once again, considered a very wealthy, wealthy family. A couple other interesting notes was that we ate dinner in this little area right up here. It was an open patio. It's very warm in India. Had the windows open, but right across the alleyway. And when I say right across, it was literally about 10 feet to the other side of the alley. You had another house similar to this, upstairs, same type of opening. The family, I guess, had never seen an American, maybe any type of a white person there for dinner. Through this whole dinner, which we for about 2 hours, I'm sitting at the end of the table, looking outside across the alleyway. To a family of about 10. And all they did the entire time was sit there and stared. So I'm eating dinner, I'm trying to talk, and I look, and they're staring. You know, they're staring. So if you can imagine being stared at for like 2 hours while you're eating dinner, it was quite the experience. But once again, they were not used to just seeing that. I threw this slide in there for those of you who like to work on, who work with manufacturing and QS 9000 and ISO 9000. Their Ministry of Defense, their army, is ISO 9000 certified. So when they blow you up, it's according to a certain quality standard. But the other thing I kind of note was you can stay at the guest house, which is right next to the pyro house, if you wanted to. So that was kind of quick background of some of the things I faced as far as on the trip to India. But as I mentioned before, there are a few critical lessons that I picked up on my trip to India. The first lesson, obviously, is if you've known anything about India, seen India, or from the pictures, India is a very poor nation. It's a developing nation, and there's a significant amount of poverty in India, just like you'll see in the Philippines and Africa. And what have you. But the lesson that I learned, because learning that India was poor was not necessarily life-changing or anything new, I knew that going over there. But the thing that I learned was that, yes, there was poverty, but it was not abject poverty. There was poverty, but it was not abject poverty. You may ask, what's the difference? Well, I didn't know until I looked it up. Abject is utterly despicable or contemptible. It is utterly despicable or contemptible. A lot of poverty or poor people in India to our standards, compared to our standards. But as I'll get here in a few minutes, it was not an abject poverty. There was not an issue of crime in India. You don't have the same issue of divorce or drug abuse, alcohol abuse, as you do, for example, in the US. They're poor, but their definition of poor and our definition of poor probably differ. When I say poverty, there's definitely plenty of poverty. This was a scene that I snapped on the way back from the plant. This is a dump site. People would take their garbage here, they would burn what they could, and never a shortage of people picking through the garbage to find something or to find something to eat. So plenty of poverty. Now, one thing that came to mind is, do we all really recognize and remember and remind ourselves as often as we need to about how much God has blessed the nation and the descendants of Israel. In Genesis 12:1, the Lord said to Abraham, "Go forth from your country and from your relatives and from your father's house to the land which I will show you, and I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, and so you shall be a blessing. And I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you I will curse, and in you all the families of the earth will be blessed." Our beliefs is that God blessed the descendants of Israel, and that God blessed, for example, the nation of America. And you see that, or you really can recognize that when you go to a place like India, which does not have the same physical blessings that we have. And you see that then in their poverty. Same thing, once again, if you go to Africa, you go to the Philippines. Do we appreciate how much God has blessed this country? When I got back after my first trip to India, I literally kissed the ground. Now, the people doing that, they just do that for show. No, I literally kissed the ground. I felt so comfortable when I climbed behind the wheel of a car and was driving back and didn't feel, didn't feel like my life was in danger. Now, of course, that may be a surprise to you. Some of you thinking driving on 294, you put your life in danger. But trust me, it's not the same. It's not the same. Here's some examples as well as some of the poverty that you see in India. These type of housing developments or shacks, they call them shanty towns, are all over the place in India. I have a picture a little bit later as well, but what you have here is either 10, some type of metal fabrication. If you're lucky, it's brick, but typically it's metal. 1 to 2 rooms with a small roof. And you will see miles and miles and miles, square miles, of these shanty towns. I don't know how they know where to get their mail if they ever do such a thing. It's amazing, the little shanty towns. But I want to mention poverty. When you think, well, India, if they don't have this money, if you see them living in shacks, like we just saw, if one person may get paid at the most a couple hundred dollars to spend their whole year making a beautiful silk-on-silk throw rug, it cannot be a very enjoyable place to live. You're much better blessed to be in the U.S. Back in 2006, a group of London economics professors did a survey on happiness of countries, and they ask a number of different questions that then derive towards happiness. And happiness was on contentment. Are you content? And the family setting. And as you can imagine, where I'm going with this, the U.S. ended up ranked 46th. We're the richest country in the world, and we ended up 46th. Anyone guess where India ranked? Fifth. India ranked fifth. And their response of how these London economic professors defined happiness. And their happiness is more of what Paul described when he said, be content. And that is to be satisfied. You think about the contrast between what we see here in the U.S. It's nothing but a pursuit of continued goods, an accumulation of goods. Yes, we try to provide our family a comfortable level of living. But the poverty line and the definition of poverty in this country is completely different of what you see in India. Poverty in this country, you're living like a king in India. But when you look at happiness and people are being content, India ranks fifth. And I was talking about this because I was talking about this survey because it had just come out when I was over there. General manager was talking about the survey and how India has, because he has a daughter that lives in the U.S., so he definitely has a fair comparison here and definitely knows both countries. He was talking about the difference between India and the U.S. And his observation, he's not converted, does not read the scriptures, doesn't read the words of Christ and words of Paul and inspired by God, and he was saying the difference between the U.S. and the India, U.S., You pursue the wrong things. You focus on the wrong things. In India, we have a very strong family structure. a lot of marriages continue to be arranged over there, and I'm not advocating that by all means, but the importance and the importance placed on a family, the importance that's placed on marriage, the importance that's placed on that when you do marry someone, it's very important to give, to love, to, you know, to share with that person. And that's why marriages and families are so strong in India. If you look at James 1 in verse 9, you see warnings that were provided by James on what we're talking about here. He said, but the brother of the humble circumstances is to glory in his high position. You know, if we are humbled and if we're relying upon God, there's certain glory in that position to be reliant upon God. And the rich man is to glory in his humiliation, because like flowering grass, he will pass away. For the sun rises with a scorching wind and withers the grass, and its flowers falls off, and the beauty of its appearance is destroyed. So too the rich man in the midst of his pursuits will fade away. As the old joke goes, have you ever seen a luggage rack on the top of a hearse? We can't take it with us. And we focus on the rich things. They will soon fade away. This is the picture I was telling you about. This is right outside of Mumbai. But literally, square miles of nothing but shanty towns. When we think about, do we have enough goods? When we think about, are we doing as well as we would like to be physically? Once again, it's very fair, it's a very good thing to want to take care of our family. But we need to keep in mind, when it comes to God's definition of wealth, when it comes to God's definition of happiness, it's not how much that we have. It's not about the quality of house we live in. As we see from India, you could be living in a house that would be considered poverty here, but still have a very happy life. Nothing wrong with having goods, but do we focus on the right thing? The second thing, that the lesson that I picked up on my trip to India, was amazing to see the culture of paganism. And what do I mean by that? You know, let's dig into it and you'll see what I mean. Wherever you look in India, we already talked about worshiping cows, worshiping elephants, many, many gods. It's also a culture that pulls together whatever religions that are represented in the culture. I got more cards or Christmas cards or emails from people in India and flashy than I've ever seen before. You know, they any type of religion, a Muslim religion, they will close schools and have parties for Muslim holidays, Hindu holidays, Christian holidays. So they pretty much do about anything. As an example, when I was over there the third time, they were finally getting up to the level of production that we wanted them to. And so in celebration, they did a flag ceremony. Now the flag ceremony goes back many, many, many years, centuries. It goes back centuries. And the flag ceremony was performed whenever an honored person, an important person, goods, they were to leave, they would do this flag ceremony. So these symbols go back many years. They would put on, in this case, since they were shipping out steering arms to us, they would put prayer flowers. They would drape the truck in prayer flowers. This is the Hindu priest who just burning incense and now saying a blessing over the truck. This is AY, the same person you saw before, but part of it is they would take coconuts. Coconuts are a sign of good luck in the Indian culture. They would crack the floor or crack the coconut on the ground and then pour the coconut juice on the truck itself. And the interesting thing, though, is did I include the picture? No, I didn't. As they had gone through all of this, we're standing there waiting for this truck to leave. The truck driver hops in. A truck won't start. He gets out of the truck, crawls underneath the truck, And while his head and upper body are inside the truck finally starts. And I had the same reaction. I thought we just lost the truck driver. But no, he was starting the truck. He climbs back out, climbs in the cab, and away he goes. So, and this is the Hindu priest now putting the mark on everyone's forehead. They didn't quite understand why I wouldn't do that. Oh, no, thank you. Really, no, thank you. So I had to tell him about 5 times no. So there's a picture of all of us happy that the truck's about ready to go. Everything that they do in life has a lot of symbolism, a lot of ties to their particular religions of multiple gods and multiple facets. On my third trip over there, I was fortunate enough to attend the wedding of one of the owners or executives of Kinetic. I was very honored to be invited to the wedding, because not too many people get to go to the wedding. Pretty much everyone gets invited to the reception afterwards, but very few people actually get invited to the wedding. This is was on the floor of the hotel as you entered. This is actually colored sand. So they did this design with colored sand. It was beautiful. This is the setup for the ceremony itself. There's a place for the parents and the bride and groom, and I don't know if how well you can see it. Right there is an urn for a fire. In India, the wedding ceremonies take place around a fire. Interesting thing as well about the weddings over there is that you think lots of money are spent on weddings here. Over there, it's incredible. People will actually sell land that's been in their family for generations, to be able to put on a wedding for their children. Go in debt significantly to be able to do that. But a lot is done. You see all these flowers. She has in that picture, I believe she has it. She has a flower around her that's took one person a week to do. Red is a very auspicious color as well. That's the groom and the bride and groom there, and that's where you can see the ring of flowers as well. So when they started the ceremony for this Indian wedding. The Hindu priests would be sitting there, and this ceremony itself would take, if I remember right, it took about an hour and a half. Very, very long ceremony. Interesting thing is during the ceremony, people would get up and mill around. People would talk. People would carry on conversations. At some point, and I'm thinking, this is, do you do this at weddings? And at one point in time, about halfway, they brought out the food, and people started getting up and eating. I learned later that, no, that's pretty typical, because these ceremonies are so long, they don't want the guests to have to sit through the whole ceremony. So it was pretty typical. But it was a very lengthy ceremony. Different times they're giving blessings to in this case, this is Mr. Kara and Mrs. Kara, who we worked with, her daughter and her husband-to-be. So as we carried on, a beautiful young boy there. No, that's not his hand. It's a little, looks like it's his hand, but a rather large hand for a young boy there. But you notice all the markings on the women that would be marked up for the ceremony. This is the Hindu priest once again giving, in this case, blessings on him. At one point in time, they tie their shawls together, and that's part of the process to show that they will be tied together. And then throughout the ceremony, they will actually get up, and 7 different times they will walk around this fire. But each and every time they walk around this fire, they're offering another prayer to yet another Indian god, multiple gods. More marching around. At this point in the ceremony, he is taking his ring. Or her ring, excuse me, dipped it into some red paint and is now dotting her forehead. And you see that there. And then puts the ring on. Then we exchange cake for them. It's a wafer. It's a sweet dessert that they change. Then you can see all of the flowers that are being tossed to them. Those are rose petals instead of rice. It's rose petals. And I thought this was pretty neat. This is Mr. and Mrs. Kara. Their parents. So at some point in time, they've switched. He was sitting over here, she was sitting over there, but now they've switched to kind of recognize the blending of the family. Once again, for them, it's just not a civil ceremony. It's not something to go through so you can get better benefits. You know, it's a lifelong commitment. So he's now demonstrated or considered part of their family, but they are recognizing this union, are pushing his head as his parents are on the other side pushing her head against him to symbolize this union. It's a beautiful, beautiful ceremony. But once again, full of a lot of pagan rituals. And it led me to a certain paradox. Because there's one thing I realized about India. First of all, is that the Hindus, and also many of the Muslims there in India, the Hindus are a very spiritual person. I mean, you hit a cow, you know, or you hit a deer here, you take them home and you flay them up and have them for dinner. You hit a cow there, you fast for 3 days because you just hit this sacred animal that represents God. They are very spiritual people in everything, and everything that they do. The Indians as well demonstrate a tremendous amount of love and peace and joy. You saw the survey and the results that we saw, and that survey on happiness. In my experience, I did not have an unpleasant experience with anyone while I was over there. I felt safe to, if I wanted to go out and walk out in the streets. Crime was almost non-existent, with the one exception of theft. People didn't mind putting their hands on other people's property. Besides that, you did not see or have an issue with crime and violent crime that you have here in the U.S. When you talk about theft, that was one thing I learned as well. By the time the third trip over there, I finally learned that someone gave me the best advice. If you want to beat the symptoms of having to travel to India, get yourself some Johnny Walker and some Coke, and have yourself a glass of Johnny Walker and Coke at night. So I think it helped. It certainly helped being gone from home for so long. Anyway, the point is I would come in, I would notice after I bought the first bottle of Johnny Walker or on the trip, when I bought the bottle of Johnny Walker, that is, I only had one. That sounded bad, didn't it? The first bottle. By the time I got to the fifth, when I bought the bottle of Johnny Walker and I had it, I'd come home from work the next day, go get my medicine, and I would notice that I would have less Johnny Walker than I had when I left. So the housing staff didn't mind helping themselves to my Johnny Walker. But anyway, the Hindus are very, very peaceful. They're very loving. They're very spiritual people. And when you ask. Those who do not completely understand the truth, well, you know, what's the definition of being a Christian? And a definition of being a Christian is to show love and to show joy, and that is a large part, as we all know, of being a Christian. And if those are part of the fruit of the Spirit, but you know, this is where the apparent paradox come in, because if you have a group of people that are so lovable, so peaceable, there are also they worship many gods, and they're ignorant of the one true God. As we read the scriptures, as God has revealed our open minds, not because we're special, not because we're smarter or better looking or anything like that, but God has opened our minds to the scriptures and to explain that, no, you know, I am the one true God. You're to worship me. He's opened these to us, and if you follow me and worship me and live a certain life, this is what I expect. But as you can see, some of that dovetails with the type of life that we are supposed to lead. And I was challenged quite a bit by by some folks back when I was making the trips to India about, well, how can you say someone is a Christian or not a Christian, when they demonstrate so much love? And I see that as a people, India demonstrate a lot of love. Atheists demonstrate a lot of love, or some atheists demonstrate a lot of love. Being a Christian means that you show love towards one another, but that is not the complete story of what does it mean to be a Christian. Yes, we should show love. Yes, we should show joy. That is the peace, or that's fruits of the Spirit. But that is not the complete picture, as we know. That's only a portion of the picture, as we understand it. As it says in Romans in 1:22 and verse 25, professing to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the incorruptible God for an image in the form of the corruptible man, of birds and four-footed animals and crawling creatures. That describes my friends in India. I love them to pieces. They're wonderful people. But they worship animals. They worship birds. They worship and have many gods. Therefore, God gave them over in the lust of their hearts to impurity, so that their bodies would be dishonored among them. For they exchanged the truth of God for a lie and worship and serve the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. And some will challenge, I want to be a Christian. It's all about being spiritual. It's all about being good. It's all about showing love, which, once again, you cannot discount the importance of those things. God said, if you're my disciples, you will have love for one another. Those are very important. But don't someone try to trick you to say, well, if God says you should show love and you're showing the fruit of the love, and this is a big one I believe Oprah Winfrey was pushing, if you show love to one another, then you're honoring God. That's what Christianity is all about. It's a huge part of Christianity, but it's not everything, as we know and understand. In John 14:21, he who has my commandments and keeps them is the one who loves me. If we say we love God, we want to keep all his commandments. All his commandments. Not just the commandment about love and peace, which are very important for us. But it's not everything. It is not all. And I will love him and will disclose myself to him. Jesus answered and said to him, if anyone loves me, he will keep my word, and my Father will love him, and he will come to him and make our abode with him. He who does not love me does not keep my words, and the word which you hear is not mine, but the Father's who sent me. And that's how we resolve the paradox. Yes, Indians are lovely people. Good friends. I really respect the people of India and enjoyed my time that I spent there. I do. But we need to keep the whole word and the whole law. The third example that I saw, or I took home when I was over there, was a tremendous example of faith. When I went over there for my first trip, and by the way, I made three trips, about two to three weeks each trip. I made three trips over there. On the first trip, when I found out that I was going, I called David Baker, the regional pastor over Asia, and said, heading to India, do we have any brethren in India? Can I meet up with someone while I'm over there? Because, a billion people, I come to find out we had at the time one member in India. Thought, well, so much for that. A billion people, 1 million, probably we won't get to see him. Prakash, the member in India, lived about 5 kilometers from the hotel where I was staying in Pune. So, while I was over there, I got to visit with Prakash. That's Prakash. Prakash Mandora, holding baby. That's Prakash and Sarah. Sarah is Prakash's wife and baby, their daughter. I don't know baby's name because they just called her baby. Baby, don't do this. Baby, no. Stop, baby. Come on. Come meet baby. So I never got her name. So that's baby. And then Sarah's brother and a friend. So my first trip over there, I got to meet with them and spend the Sabbath with them. At the time, once again, the only member in United. Other Sabbath keepers, as a matter of fact, Sarah's family is a Seventh-day Adventist. And there's other Church of God organizations in India, but they are truly alone. by themselves. When we talk about happiness, Prakash and his wife, for many years, and I think they're actually now back in, they live actually in one of these shanties. That's where Prakash and Sarah live. Prakash, as well, to be able, or to anyone to be able to work in India, you pretty much have to work on Saturday. They don't really recognize weekends as we do here. And if you want to hold a job in India, more than not, you have to work on the Sabbath. So it's been very difficult for Prakash to find a job to be able to work and support their family and keep the Sabbath. So as a result, he does not want to, obviously, he wants to hold true to the commandments, as we just read, wants to observe the Sabbath and keep the Sabbath. Therefore, since he has trouble with income, that's why Prakash and Sarah and baby do live in one of these type of houses in Shantytown. But he's not willing to give up his faith. As a matter of fact, he's on fire. When I was over there, he's talking about all the things he wanted to do and help with getting the good news circulated to India. He was telling me, "Can you talk with Mr. Baker? Because I want to get the good news all over India, and he won't send me the good news, you know." And of course, Mr. Baker is like, "How do we don't have anyone to take care? You know, we can't satisfy a market of a billion people. We need to make sure we're prepared, and we just can't start sending out good news, because then how do we help and support these people?" So we need to make sure as we grow the work in India, we do it with the ability to support the people as well. But he's on fire. He's on fire. And wants to do what he can to spread God's word while living in this type of a house, because he can't work on the Sabbath. While over there for the Sabbath, at the end of the Sabbath, they took me to the snake park. It's a zoo. When they told me that they were taking me to the snake park, I thought, what in the world? But it's a beautiful zoo there in Pune, and you get to see many different animals, including these here sitting on the hillside. That's what it looks like to travel 20 hours and have jet lag. But Prakash and his family come to mind anytime now when I read Hebrews 11 and verse 8. By faith, Abraham, when he was called, obeyed by going out to a place which was to receive for an inheritance. And he went out not knowing where he was going. By faith, he lived as an alien in the land of promise and as in a foreign land, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, fellow heirs of the same promise. For he was looking for the city which has foundations, whose architect and builder is God. That's Prakash. Prakash and Sarah. My third trip over there was a continuation of experiences I'll never forget. Because the third trip when I went over there, I actually was at work Monday morning. By about 10 o'clock, I went into my boss's office and said, "They're having problems again. I need to go." He says, "I agree with you. You need to go." By that afternoon, or about an hour later, I was heading home, called Tammy on the cell phone and said, "Guess what? Guess where I'm going?" So by 5 o'clock that night, I was on a plane to India. The interesting thing was, this was about 4 or 5 days before the start of the spring feast. It's a difficult thing to do, but I counseled with Mr. Inisco at the time and felt that it was a proper thing to do, that I can observe the feast as well while I am in India, obviously. But the joy was I got to observe it with Prakash. Prakash was by himself, because at the time Sarah was not baptized. He was by himself. You talk about, you know, being alone for the second Passover. You know, he was alone for the first Passover. So he was by himself. But now I was happy to be able to be with him. And that's quite the experience itself, because he picked me up. You know, I was thinking, well, we do it in the room. Well, no, he wanted me to take to the place that he was staying at the time, which, by the way, was not one of the shanty towns. At the time, his wife was going to the Seventh-day Adventist college, and she being a member, and they both helped to support some translations she helped support some translations in the Seventh-day Adventist church. They got to stay there on campus. So they wanted me to take them to their place, which is definitely steps up from the shantytown. So he comes to pick me up, and on this two-wheeler. Two-wheelers are the main levels of transportation in India. Yes, some cars, but foot, but primarily two-wheelers. As a matter of fact, that's kind of like the family vehicle. I kid you not, many times I would see a family of four on a two-wheeler. You'd have the dad up front, the older child sitting between his legs, hanging onto the handlebars, the mom sitting side saddle on the back holding the baby, and they would go through the streets as a family of four that way. But he picked me up on the moped, a two-wheeler. Now, if you remember the picture, Prakash is probably not much more than 4'10 and 80 pounds soaking wet. So he's on the front of this two-wheeler, and I'm on the back. And we're going through the streets of Pune, this small little, even for Indian standards, a very small man, and this big white pasty guy on the back. And we'd come up to a stoplight, and people would, you know, look over and give us the old double take. I've never seen anything quite like that. And after we'd stop and we would go again, I would actually be like little Fred Flintstone. I'd get my feet going a little bit until we got enough forward momentum so we wouldn't pop over sideways from my weight in the back. But we went to his place for Passover. And where Sarah and Prakash were living at the time, and this was considered very nice digs, we came up on the dorm, and what the dorm was a big long row of cement blocks, and they were divided. So their place was, you came up on their house, the first place was the first room, on this, once again, series of individual apartments, the first room was just a covered porch. I couldn't stand up in the first two rooms. First porch was low, it was a covered porch. The second room was their kitchen. And there, once again, about 8 by 8, I think, 8 foot by 8 foot were these rooms. And then the third room was the bedroom. So that was where they were staying. So I had to wait outside, and they got everything ready for Passover. And so we went in, sat in the third room, in the bedroom, and had Passover. It was also interesting because Passover service here and the foot washing, everybody has their socks and shoes, and you take your socks off, and you have to worry about, you know, sock fuzz. And over there, they wear sandals. They wear sandals. So when we were doing the foot washing, it's like I was actually literally taking sandals off, and he had dusty feet. It was like what it possibly could have been, you know, a couple of centuries ago. It was an amazing experience. Anyway, I got to enjoy Passover in the spring feast with Prakash. If I hadn't been there, Prakash, the only person by himself, and his faith is unwavering. His faith was unwavering. Whether I was there or not, Passover. Whether I'm there or not, he keeps the Sabbath. Whether anyone's there or not, he's truthful to the Word of God and keeps the Sabbath. And does not give up. He does not give up on his belief. We face trials when it comes to keeping God's law, whether it be from ridicule from coworkers or fellow students, whether it be from family members. We face trials sometimes when we lose our job. I've been out of work for 6 weeks now, as an example, not me personally, but, you know, I've been out of work for 6 weeks, 6 months. I've got this opportunity. It's going to require me to work on the Sabbath. And we start to become tempted because, you know, I may lose my nice $500,000 palace, and I can't be happy if I'm not living in my half million dollar palace. Now, I'm kind of, you know, exaggerating for effect. I don't want to minimize anyone who's facing these struggles and challenges and these questions. But when we look at these questions and when we look at these trials and challenges from our perspective, from our lenses, significantly different than when you look at them through the lens of Prakash. Also, since my visit a few years back, we have closer to, I believe, about 20 members in India. So at least now for the feast, unfortunately none live close to Prakash in Pune, but at least for the feast, they can now have a feast site in India and be able to get together for the fall feast. When we face challenges, and hopefully through these examples and seeing Prakash and hearing the story of Prakash, that we now look at our trials differently. We look at what's valuable differently. I know I do. I don't look at things the same. And sometimes when I'm feeling down, I need to pull out these pictures. I need to pull out the picture of Prakash. And remember, you know, it is indeed very possible, with God's help, to be able to face the challenges. When I think about lessons from India, I think of Prakash, I think of Sarah, and I think of Baby. Have a good Sabbath.